Let's begin. Sorry for the delay in starting. Okay, tonight we continue our shiur on piyut. Namely, we had just began last week with an introduction to the classical era of Spanish piyut, the glorious, famous Hebrew piyut from the early Spanish scholars. And we discussed the history of Hebrew-Spanish poetry and Hebrew piyut, and we discussed exactly how it came to be in its, I'm just going to mute a couple people here, and how it came to be in its form. So, as we discussed last week, originally Spain was the periphery of Jewish life and Jewish culture. However, with the rise of the caliphate, what eventually became the caliphate of Cordoba, a tremendous Jewish community sprang up in that new metropolis and new magnificent city, which rivaled only the Abbasid Baghdad at the time. And because Cordoba became such a magnet for scholars and artists and patrons and merchants and Jews, Cordoba became this attracted Jewish life to Spain in a much bigger way than it had previously existed. So tremendous scholars such as Rav Moshe ben Chanoch were brought in, and they released their dependence on the Jewish centers of life in what we would call Babel, but also modern-day Iraq in Baghdad. So that is how Spain historically became a Jewish center or a Jewish epicenter at the time. And as we mentioned last week, one of the most important Jews of that era was Hastai ibn Shaprut. Hastai was a grand vizier who was Jewish, who served Abd al-Rahman III, and because of his power and his influence, he patroned a lot of Jews, he protected Jews, he sponsored a lot of yeshivot, and sponsored a lot of famous Jewish paitanim and linguists and grammarians and scholars of all sorts. Two of the famous ones that we discussed last week, that I'm recapping tonight very briefly, would be Donash ibn Labrat and Menachem ibn Saruk. Two different figures with two very different opinions about how the Hebrew language should work and how the Hebrew language should be employed for poetics, both secular and religious. So we discussed the particulars of their disagreements last week. And as we saw, Donash argued vociferously for introducing quantitative Arabic meter into Hebrew poetry. So while up until this point, Jewish poetry had been native, right? It had been a native invention with its own forms of meter, its own forms of rhyme, its own styles and devices, and even in a way its own language. Menachem ibn Saruk believed that it should remain purely native and quote-unquote holy and sacred, while Donash ibn Labrat believed that if you brought the Arabic form and all of its beauty into Hebrew and superimposed it on Hebrew, you could release a whole new wave of poetic expression, and that would benefit Hebrew greatly. Now, they obviously disagreed, but this was an argument doomed to failure, because honestly, the public was with Donash, and public opinion really, at the time, it's almost like, in the modern era today, in America, when people love something, if people love American music, they're just going to make Jewish American music. It's the way it is. And Donash really enlightened the enlightened Jews of the time. And eventually, Donash's way won. And Donash, with his ambition, boldness, and all of his character traits, managed to push that this feature should be changed. And I should emphasize that Donash's contribution at the time was specifically form. It wasn't in content. He wasn't making radical changes to Hebrew. He wasn't arguing for a different way to write Hebrew. He was arguing for an arbitrary way of adjusting the form of Hebrew poetry. But when it came to language and when it came to topics and styles, He wasn't making any strong arguments. And we see, indeed, in his time, he himself wasn't the world's most skilled poet, but he does write some nice poems with both Arabic quantitative meter and classic Hebrew meter. And he will write with with features of native Jewish poetry and native synagogal poetry, and he will put that into Arabic quantitative verse. So that was just a recap of last week, Donashe ben Labrat and his importance to the next entire millennia of Jewish of piyut and of Jewish Hebrew poetry. Now we have to focus on the next era, because Donashe represents the beginning and the spark, the artistic passion which might have birthed Spanish Hebrew poetry. But it didn't really begin to see its flowering until the next era. Famously, the Ra'avad, the historian, Rabbi Avraham ibn Dawid, he says that in the times of Chastai, and I'll just paraphrase in English, the Jews began to chirp like birds, right? They began their tweeting and their chirping. But in the days of Shmuel Hanagid, they began to sing out loud. B'yamei Shmuel Hanagid yitinu kol. It's a beautiful thing. He says, I think, B'yamei Chastai hitzchilu litzafzef, u'b'yamei Shmuel Hanagid yitinu kol. So when he's speaking about the Jewish poets, he's saying that in Spain, in the times of Chastai and Donashe, they began to begin chirping, the poets. But from the time of Shmuel Hanagid onwards, they began to sing out loud. The poets of Spain came to their blossoming and to their full form. And Shmuel Hanagid's era really represents this the first great and truly magnificent poetry, which Hebrew Spanish poetry is known for, and also the Hebrew Spanish piyut is also known for. Before we step into the realm of Shmuel Hanagid and his life story, I wanted to first do a little bit of homework to cover some things last week that we missed. The first, and again, please bear with me, this is actually kind of interesting, but it's just a little bit of homework that we need to do to allow us to progress. I just wanted to mention a few people who were in the orbit of Donashe Menachem. First of all, Donashe's wife. Donashe's wife was known to have written poetry herself, and she remains one of only two or three Jewish women to have written Hebrew poetry until roughly the 20th century. Her one surviving poem that we could say for sure is hers is a poem of longing, where she longs for her husband's return. And it is somewhat known that not only did Chastai ibn Shaprut banish Menachem from Cordoba, eventually he also banished Donashe from Cordoba for whatever reason. Chastai seemed to be a ruthless ruthless diplomat who would have no problem turning over people's lives. And Donashe had to leave his young wife and to leave his son, his only son, and escape or go into exile from Cordoba. And he writes letters of poems of complaint to Chastai, and his wife writes a letter of longing. It's a secular poem for her husband. Now, it's not unusual that a woman from Cordoba would have been literate. And Cordoba was a very progressive city-state, and in Cordoba, women worked as lawyers and as doctors and as bankers and all sorts of things. It didn't mean that they were less oppressed. On the contrary, typically when women become more exposed, they get more oppressed in religious regimes. But at the end of the day, women did have this power. They were able to hold property, just by virtue of being women being so educated and literate in Cordoba, it would lend to the theory that he met her in Cordoba, he married her in Cordoba, and she was Cordoban herself. Not that she was from Fez or from Baghdad or from the other areas where he lived. Now, if anyone is interested, there's an entry on Wikipedia for her, because feminists love pointing out the history of Donashe's wife. And it's kind of a nice poem. Hayizkori alat hachein yedida b'yom perud b'zora yechida v'sham chotam yimino al simola b'zora halo samat semida b'yom lakakha lizikaron yedido v'hu lakakh lizikaron yedida hayishayer b'chol eret sefarad v'lu lakakh hatzi malchut negida. So I'll just translate that in English. Will her love remember his graceful doe, her only son in her arms as he parted? And there's a historical reason I want to recite this poem. On her left hand, he placed a ring from his right. On his wrist, she placed her bracelet. As a keepsake, she took his mantle from him, and he in turn took hers from her. Would he settle now in the land of Spain if its prince gave him half his kingdom? What she's saying is that would he stay if the prince Chastai would give him half his kingdom? Like, wondering about the longing and the love of her husband. Clearly, this was written in response to this occurrence in his life where he had to leave on the behest of Chastai's banishment. Okay, that is the first person of his orbit that we should mention. The second person of Donash's orbit that we should mention is actually a supporter of Menachem, one of the disciples of Menachem, Rabbi Yitzchak ibn Kafron. And Rabbi Yitzchak ibn Kafron penned and wrote a slicha, well, at least one slicha, and a few poems that we know of. They're important because one of them is an attack on Donash and on his foreign influence on Lashon HaKodesh. And what's fun about it is that he writes it in beginning with, he begins it with quantitative Arabic meter. And what he's trying to demonstrate is that any man, woman, or child can do this. It's not, this is no big trick. Anybody can write Hebrew poetry in Arabic quantitative meter. The reason I don't do it is because it's unbefitting, not because it's out of my capability. And Ibn Kafron's, his detractors used to make fun of him because Kafron in the Romance language of the time, which they didn't all speak Arabic. Some of the Jews spoke the earlier Romance, Spanish Latin. But in that language, it meant like a goat. So they used to call him the Ez or the goat. He wasn't befriended by everybody. But he has he basically mimics Donash's own poem called the Eli Bi Chochma. Donash. I go through his name in different ways. Sometimes I say Donash. Sometimes I say Donash. Doesn't really make a difference. And let me just show it to you for a second. He writes in this letter, this is a letter to Chasdai ibn Shaprut in quantitative meter, in Arabic meter. This is, I believe, I think he's mimicking a meruba. I'm not sure. What was the words I wanted to bring from here? Vatsliach darko. I'm sorry, give me one second. Oh, here we go. So he says like this: "Vizehu hu ben labrat asher lashav charat v'chashav ki parat v'chalal ba'amarim lashon kodesh hichrit." Right? He destroyed lashon hakodesh asher hi l'sheirit b'shoklo ha'evrit with his Hebrew, so to speak, meter b'mishkalim zarim with foreign what's it called, scales or meters asher bam nitatzim pituchim ukmusim v'yu nifratzim giderot nigdarim. He's basically saying that they're breaking and being put together. Ubitshivot azot hashivoti alzot, and with forceful tshivot, I replied to him on this. V'ho'el na lachazot chacham kolei yitzurim. And this is basically, the rest of it goes on to entreat Chasdai to no longer find favor with Donash ibn Labrat. So this is a person who's somewhat important to the history. He's one of the chief disciples of Donash. That's number one. His the sole slicha that he has. I did not find it in time. Chaim Sherman says that it doesn't show that any particular poetic force, that he wasn't a specifically gifted paitan, both in the classical or either in the classical or in the new genre. However, he was an important person because from him we glean a lot of information about this dispute between Menachem and Donash, since these letters were written mostly by their disciples. The next one is actually very interesting. The next person was a Talmid of Donash, not Menachem, right? Yitzchak ibn Mar Shaul. He was a resident of Lucina, which was southeast of Cordoba. And Lucina was a mostly Jewish town, and it was much less affected by the politics of Cordoba throughout the years, because there's a civil war that we're going to discuss soon, and all sorts of things. So the Jews who lived in Lucina, especially because it was a predominantly Jewish town, they had a lot more religious freedom and a lot more relative peace than Jews in other areas. Now, he's considered a disciple of Donash, but he's also known to be the teacher of the famous Yonah ibn Janach, who is one of the foremost linguists and grammarians of Jewish history, who really began properly deciphering the grammar and the diktuk of Lashon HaKodesh. Donash and Menachem started, but it was really Yonah ibn Janach who properly figured it out. And he was a Talmid, famously, of Yitzchak ibn Mar Shaul, who began to teach him his ways of Dikduk. Now, he's noted for two things. The two famous things he's noted for in the secular realm, he's noted for being the first person to introduce the Arabic convention of the Sibi. In Arabic poetry, there's a genre called Sibi poetry. Sibi means the fawn, right? The young deer, the young gazelle. And in Hebrew, he translated this to the tzvi, For some reason of which I am not familiar, because this is already 1,000 years old, more, 1,400 years old, for some reason in Arabic poetry, a young attractive male who is enchanting and cruelly subjects his admirers and puts them in, hooks people in and like a player, so to speak. You know what I mean? Like a cruel lover who's an attractive male is called a sibi, like a tzvi. And he takes this Arabic convention and uses it in Hebrew. And we'll recap what, how this works, how the secular stuff works in at the end of the shiur. But what he's famous in the secular realm, at least around the year 1000, for migrating or copying, really, the Arabic genre of Sivi. But in the Hebrew, in the Kodesh realm, he is much more famous for doing, for writing the famous, very, very famous bakasha called Elokai Al Tidineni Kima Ali, right? Everybody knows this from Rosh Hashanah. I believe, how does it go again? I remember I opened up, we have Moshe Chabusha. I don't know if you could hear that, but Elokai Al Tidineni Kima Ali, right? Ve'al Tamod Elechi Ki Kefali. This is something that almost every Sephardic Jew would be familiar with. This piyut. It's a very beautiful piyut that people say before Baruch Sha'amar on Rosh Hashanah, and it's entreating Hashem not to judge me according to my sins. Only judge me according to your mercy. The ideas aren't original in Elokai Al Tidineini. These are very common, typical ideas of a slicha. However, this slicha / bakasha is really one of the most beautiful slichot or bakashot written of this era. And scholars of piyut consider this to be really the opening of the beauty of Spanish piyut and Spanish poetry. It wasn't until Yitzhak Ibn Mar Shaul that we truly see real beauty. And everybody who has sung Elokai Al Tidinei Kemali and felt the beauty of the lyrics and the beauty of the language and the beauty of the meter and rhythm begins to understand and appreciate, really, Spanish Hebrew piyut and Spanish Hebrew poetry. So that's what he is famous for. It spread, Elokai Al Tidineni Kemali spread all the way from Western Europe to Turkey, and it is known by many Jews today. Just as mentioned, the next person of this era is Yosef Ibn Abitur. Yosef Ibn Abitur, we gave an entire shiur to, number 6 in the Paitanim series. And Yosef Ibn Abitur was one of the greatest scholars in Cordoba during the reign of Hastai Ibn Shaprut. He studied with Rabbi Moshe Ben Rabbi Chanoch. And when Rabbi Moshe Ben Rabbi Chanoch passed away as the leader of the Jewish people of Cordoba, Hastai installed Chanoch Ben Rabbi Moshe, his son, to be the leader of the Jewish people. And Yosef Ibn Abitur, with the vacuum of power, with Hastai no longer alive, made a bid for the rabbinate. He said, no, Chanoch should not be the chief rabbi, I should be the chief rabbi. We don't know exactly the details, but as I said in the Shi'ur, he eventually left Spain, he was put in Cherem. He spent the majority of his productive years in Egypt, and most of his poetry is written in the classical genres. He does have a few Arabic meter poems, but again, we discussed that at length, and he really just another time. He really belongs to the late Eastern school of Hebrew piyut, but he is from a Meridian family. He's from Merida, and he was an important Spanish poet. However, he doesn't really neatly fall into the category of someone who was in Donatius' orbit or somebody who was part of this, this revolution in Spain, simply because he left and he spent most of his productive years in Egypt. So now, finally, Tzvi is joining us now. Finally, that we finished our homework on the people of Donatius' orbit, we can begin speaking about the great, the one and only Shmuel Hanagid. So who was Shmuel Hanagid, and why is he so famous? So to begin with, Shmuel Hanagid was born in the year 993 to a well-off, wealthy family from Merida, which is one of the oldest Jewish communities in Spain. And it's, I think, north to Cordoba. He was born himself in Cordoba, even though his family was Meridian and they were from there. he was born in Cordoba. Most likely his family migrated there for business. In his youth, he received a classical Jewish education. Because he was wealthy, he was learned in Talmud, he was learned in he knew Tanakh Baal Peh, he was trained properly by Rabbanim, and according to his own account of his studies, he received a very intensive education. When they made him learn, and when he learned, you know, with a fierce Mesiris Nefesh for Limud HaTorah. And there's even a poem, we can talk about his poetry later, but there's a poem where he mocks the yeshiva style of learning that he encountered in Granada. It's actually a very funny poem, but he himself considered his own education in Jewish studies and in Torah to be an extremely intensive one. And besides that, because he was from a wealthy family, he also received an extensive education in Arabic and in science, philosophy, and all the quote-unquote Greek subjects. And from a very young age, his ambition and his brilliance were simply extraordinary. It was only, there was barely anybody who could match this young man's astuteness and brilliance and simple ambition. Now, in the year 1013 in Cordoba, a civil war broke out. There was a Berber war, and they attacked the state of Cordoba, with the caliphate, really. And they sent most residents fleeing, especially the Jews. So Shmuel Hanagid moved to Malaga, which was a province on the periphery of Granada, which was another Berber state, which eventually became one of the Taifa states, and it developed into its own powerful city-state. Granada was many of the other Taifa states around Cordoba began to mimic their model of creating an Abbasid-style court and creating a government system modeled on the Arabic government system. So all the Taifa states like Sevilla and Granada and Cordoba and 40 others were in competition with each other. So he moved to a suburb of Granada. And the Ravad, Rabbi Avraham ibn Dawid, says a story about how it came to be that he became a prominent, also like chief vizier, similar to the way Chastai ibn Shaprut became a chief vizier. And I mentioned this story last week in relation to Chastai, but I misremembered. Chastai's story of rise to greatness, as it's told, is that he discovered the miracle cure of teriyaka and he became the physician to the king. But this separate story is a slightly suspect story, but I'll read it to you in English. It was written originally in the Sefer HaKabbalah of the Ravad ibn Dawid. The gist of it goes like this. The king of Granada's name was Habus ibn Mahsan, right? And he had a katib. His katib's name was ibn al-Arif. A katib means like a scribe or a chief of communication. He's the guy who's supposed to be the man of words. He's the chief diplomat. He writes all the letters for the king. So the king's council, this katib ibn al-Arif, lived right next door to, guess what? Shmuel HaNagid. And occasionally the maidservant was cordial with Shmuel HaNagid, and she got Shmuel HaNagid to start writing letters instead of her master, like when her master needed extra, when Ibn al-Arif needed an extra hand, Shmuel HaNagid would help him out with his letters. Now, Habus was so impressed by Ibn al-Arif's skills that he promoted Ibn al-Arif and depended as his wise counsel and as an advisor. So Ibn al-Arif faked it and he just brought Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid as a counsel to him. And any advice he would give to the king, he would really steal from Shmuel HaNagid. Now, on Ibn al-Arif's deathbed, the king came to him and said, "What am I going to do without you? How could you die? If I don't have a wise advisor like you, I'll be gone." And Ibn al-Arif admitted that it was never his own wise counsel. It was never his own wise writing. It was always the writing of Shmuel HaNagid. And therefore, after his death, King Habus promoted Shmuel HaNagid to the place of Ibn al-Arif. Now that's the story the Ravad brings. However, it seems to be an embellishment, if not a mistake, because this is suspiciously similar to a very similar story about the Chamberlain of Cordoba, whose name was Ibn Abi Amir, which is an Arabic story, which is basically the exact same story just said in Arabic. So whoever this story really happened with is not important. What we do know is that some of the details of the story might be true. Because clearly he was a merchant. Like he had the story goes that he had a spice store next to next to Ibn al-Arif's home. But clearly he was a merchant of some kind who was very successful in Granada, and he eventually, because of his success, rose to power very quickly. His success and his ambition, he rose to power fairly quickly in Granada. First, he became the Jewish tax collector. And it's much easier from a governmental perspective, and you have to understand politics in that day, but it was much easier to get a Jew to collect tax. It's much easier to get a Jew to collect taxes from Jews than it is to get an Arab to collect taxes from Jews. It is also much easier to get a Jew to collect taxes from the Catholic population and the non-Berber population than it is to get a Catholic, because the Catholic here you have a Berber minority. A Berber minority ruling over a mixed population of Jews and Catholics and people who aren't, and Arabs, people who are not Berber. So the Berbers can't trust the Catholic majority. They can't trust the Arabs, but they could trust the Jews, because the Jews are the minority of them all. And the only people the Jews would cheat is if they were cheat for their own good. But they're not going to cheat when it comes. They're not going to take bribes from Christians, because they don't have any relationships with Christians. So he became a tax collector. He became a chief tax collector. Eventually, he was appointed and promoted to the vizier's assistant. After he became the vizier's assistant, he was appointed at the age of 34 in 1027 to be the Nagid of Granada. And it's not clear who gave him this title. Like, Nagid means like the governor, but it could have been Rav Hai Gaon. It could have been self-imposed. But at the age 34, he was considered the Gadol Hador. He was considered, this was the guy who paskined all the halacha shaylas. This is the rabbi of the Jews. Chief rabbi, chief governor, chief king of the Jews was this 34-year-old Shmuel Hanagid. So you can just imagine the esteem in which either the Arabs held him or which the Jews held him. If Rav Hai Gaon was calling him Shmuel Hanagid, then impressively, he was an outstanding Torah scholar. Now, in the year 1031, the Caliphate of Cordoba fell, and many of the Taifa states began to increase in their power. When the king of Granada, Habus, died, there was a competition between his two eldest sons who should become king. And Shmuel Hanagid was a smart man. He knew that the oldest son was a bit of a loser, and the older son was not good for the Jews. So what he did was that he emphatically pushed to get the second to oldest son, whose name was Badis, to become the next king. And because he succeeded as a ambitious, fearless diplomat or of some sort, he became, Badis became the king, and Badis, in gratitude, made Shmuel Hanagid the grand vizier. Not just the assistant to the vizier, but the actual grand vizier of Granada in 1037. So you can imagine, he's only 44 years old, and he is the Grand Vizier of Granada. Incredibly, part of those duties of being the Grand Vizier of Granada was not just to be the king's first counsel, but he was also the general of his army. He worked like as the chief of staff, so to speak. It's either some sort of Pentagon-like capacity or some sort of general from the sidelines, but it's clear from his own poetry and his son's own history that Shmuel Hanagid fought on the front lines himself. He spent 16 of the next 18 years of his life operating as an on-field and off-field general to the king of Granada, and he won most of the battles. As a general, he was extremely successful. And despite these capacities as being an absolute warrior, he remained the chief scholar of the Jewish people, he remained the chief leader of the Jewish people, and the chief patron of Torah and the chief patron of the arts and Baal Tzedakah and Askin and all of those things. So you can imagine how brilliant Rav Shmuel Hanagid had to be to do all of those things at one time. And on top of all that, besides being a great warrior of historical greatness, besides being a great rabbi of historical greatness, his poetry might be what he is known the best for, because of all of these things, he is the first truly great Spanish poet. Poetry comes to him with such an incredible ease and such an incredible skill that it's hard to put into words. Shmuel Hanagid's command of Hebrew piyut and Hebrew poetry is really a breathtaking gift, almost a God-given gift that he has for the art of words. And it's famous that he published not one, not two, but three diwans. A diwan is a collection of poems from a poet. Like in the time of the earlier poets introduced something called a ma'amad. A ma'amad was like a collection for a certain holiday, right? Most of them wrote synagogal poetry. So they would write a collection, let's say a full collection for Yom Kippur, a ma'amad. Here's a reshut, here's a zulat, here's a kedushta, here's a avodah. Like a whole bunch of, a whole collection of piyutim for the holiday. But in their time, they copied the Arabs and they would write a diwan, or a divan, however you want to pronounce it. And a diwan is basically like a book of poetry that is your collection, your portfolio. And he wrote three. One is called Ben Tehillim, which, like as David HaMelech, represents his youth, his fierceness, his ambition, his wars. The next one is called Ben Mishle, which, like Shlomo HaMelech in his middle ages, represents his maturity, his meditations, his wisdom poetry. And then finally, Ben Kohelet, where you find a lot of his mortality poetry, his grief poetry, a lot of the end-of-life kind of ruminations that a man of his stature was having. And based on the loss of his brother, you could also see a time where his poetry turns darker and more mature. So it's a very interesting, from a poetic perspective and an artistic perspective, because you see his poetry reflect different moods throughout his life, it is actually kind of interesting to observe. He has way too much poetry, secular poetry, for us to analyze tonight, or ever, really. There's hundreds of piyutim from him, and they were published with extensive commentary by a professor in Eretz Yisrael. His name was Dov Yarden. One of his family members published, first of all, his... do I have it in front of me? I better have it in front of me. Hold up. One of his family members, Jardine, here we go. Jardine, Dov, the website is dov.jardine, like jarden.co.il. So I think it's probably his daughter, his niece, his granddaughter. Somebody created this amazing website where Professor Yarden's books, which are sadly not in print anymore, are still available to be viewed. And I'm just going to share my screen for a second to show you the website because it's so useful. If anybody wants to see the Diwan of Rav Shmuel HaNagid, here is all of Professor Dov Yarden's Svarim. You have his Svarim of Rabbi Shlomo Begamirol, Shmuel HaNagid, Shir Yehuda HaLevi, Emmanuel HaRomi, all the things he wrote on. And he wrote three thick volumes on Rav Shmuel HaNagid. This is the Diwan Ben Tehillim, the Diwan Ben Mishle, and the third Diwan Ben Kohelet. Not all of them are complete, like we don't have the full Diwan of Rav Shmuel HaNagid for every single Diwan, but we have enough of it to get a very good idea of what level of Paitan he was. You could also download these PDFs. It's a very nice website, and much appreciation goes out to his daughter or granddaughter, whoever she is, because she really made... These books are not accessible anymore. You're not going to find them anywhere besides a library, so it's wonderful. If anybody wants to read through the Diwan or reference some of the piyutim that we're going to discuss tonight, they are definitely here on this website, which is dov.jardin.co.il. Okay, I'm going to stop that share. Alrighty, let's continue. Where are we? We are... Okay, so his secular range, let's first speak about his secular range. The secular range of his poetry is, in a word, incredible. It probably covers roughly 80% of the poetry that we have from him. Only about 20% of it is religious in nature. He has poems about war. He has poems that are like Arabic boast poems. He has poems about wine, about love, about lust. He has poetry about friendship, about wisdom, about grief. And he really covers the entire oeuvre of Arabic, of the Arabic conventions and the Arabic genres. Both Rabbi Moshe ibn Ezra and Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra admired Rav Shmuel HaNagid greatly. They thought he was brilliant, both religiously and poetically. They considered him almost like a model of genius, a model of Hebrew piyut and a model of Hebrew poetry to absolute genius. And when Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra writes his polemic against Rabbi Lazar HaKalir, it seems almost like when he's speaking about the Tzachut HaLashon, or a model of proper Hebrew piyut, it seems almost like his model and his mind is somebody like Rav Shmuel HaNagid. If you read through it, That's what it would seem from Rabbi Avraham ibn Ezra. Now, I was surprised, honestly, by if you look at some of his poetry, let me take out one over here. Some of his poems are a mixture between secular and religious. So when he writes, let's say, Selichot, he writes very normal Selichot. Right? His Selichot are quite normal. They might be they might have Spanish piyut in nature, but they're very typical of Selicha natures. But when he writes poetry about war, he doesn't always write it in the vengeful, hateful Arabic way that certain Arabic war poems are read. You see in him, he will sometimes write his war poems as prayers. So let me just read to you one here. This is a tefillah right before he began a battle. Re'e hayom b'tzarati, shema ushe atarati, zecha davar la'avdecha ve'al evosh b'sivrati. Hatagi al rali yad, va'at yadi v'sitrati, yad atini v'tavta b'yad sidim b'sorati. And let me just read to you the last line. Ve'im eini chidai etzlach, right? Oh, sorry. Asei li ta'avat libi, please do Hashem as I hope. And as it v'chusha na l'ezrati, and please hurry to my aid. Vim eini chidai etzlach, and if I am not worthy of your aid, Hashem, asei livni v'torati. Do it for the sake of my son and for the sake of the Torah. And of my Torah, meaning for the only things I know in my life, like he's having a moment of mortality. The only things that I know for sure in my life that I did that were good, the only things that I know made my life worth living were my learning and my son. His son, whose name is Yehosaph, who succeeded him. It's jarring in its beauty. It's really an incredible, incredible poem. And if you think about it, I was very surprised at his war poems because this is a man who is so fearless that you would almost think he was a sociopath. He was an incredibly bold, incredibly ambitious person. And I sometimes wondered, how was he so crazy? Like, he had the guts to write a polemic on the Quran, really, commentary on the Quran, in his own lifetime while he served a Muslim king. He wrote, I'll just repeat that, he was the vizier, he was the chief assistant to a Muslim king, and he wrote a polemic on the Quran. This is a man of unbelievable fearlessness. And I was wondering, what is wrong with this person? This is a man who's gone out to war for 16 years, battle after battle after battle. We see that from his poetry that he does know fear. He's human. And he expresses the broad range of human feelings and human emotions with absolute stunning clarity and beauty. Who is this person? What's wrong with him? How is he so ambitious and so fearless? And so a clue, I didn't have time, unfortunately, today to get to the library to find this inside. But Professor Chaim Sherman says that in his youth, when he was a very young man, Shmuel Hanagid claims that he received a dream. And in his dream, the angels Michael and Gabriel came to him. And they told him, do not fear. If you come to hell or high water, you come to fire, you come before any danger you're in, you are going to do great things in your life. And no matter what danger you come before, we promise we will protect you. And so it is possible that this promise of the angels that he received in his dream gave him some sort of ambition, some sort of fearlessness to really become the man that he became and to take the daring risks that he took, the really unbelievable risks that he took in his life. Now, similar to Chasdai ibn Chasdai ibn Shaprut, very similar to Chasdai, he was like, as this grand general, he might have been a patron of scholarship, a protector of the Jews. He might have also served the Arabs. But unlike Chasdai, he wasn't really a man of diplomacy and coercion. Like, if you think about the way Chasdai was, he operated more like a little bit of a mafia head. He protected the Jews, but he also used his power with incredible ruthlessness. He was a master of diplomacy and a master of coercion. But if you look at Rabbi Shmuel Hanagid's way of running things, he had no time for diplomacy. This was a man of compellence. This was a man who told you what to do. He told you how it was, and he didn't take no for an answer. This was a fierce, really fierce He was very, not fierce in a scary way, but a very fierce, a person with fierce ambition. And to put it in the, I wish I had Peter Cole's way of putting it, but he said, like, he said the Jewish poets, they were not rabbis, they were not crumpet-munching literati in tights, they weren't rabbis with free time. The poets of the Jewish poets of Spain were men of deep learning. They were men of fierce ambition. They were men of great passion. They were men of deep faith. These were men of a deep faith which really doesn't translate well into the way we understand Emunah today. The people like Rabbi Yehuda Levi and like Shmuel HaNagid and Shlomo ben Gabirol, the way these people believed in Hashem, the way they had a relationship with Hashem is really, when you go through their poetry, you realize translates poorly into English. And Shmuel HaNagid will really give you a sense of what it meant to be a God-fearing Jew of that time. And so let me just read a little bit more of his poetry with you together. And let's see another war poem from this warrior of God, so to speak. Here he begins. He was about to begin a war. He seems to use, by the way, when it comes to Arabic meter, there's a lot to discuss in, from a technical perspective of how he did his poetry. There's really a lot to discuss. But typically, a lot of the poems that outside of the Diwan that are collected, a lot of them come in Mishkal Marnin, Mishkal Meruba, Mishkal HaMitpashet. He seems to have a few kind of meters that he prefers. This one, as the one we saw previously, was Mishkal HaMarnin. Says Lich. He begins. This is a poem. As he was at war with an enemy whose name was Ibn Abi Musa, and he heard that his enemy died. So he writes a Shavach to Hashem. And we have more to discuss besides his religious poetry. But here it goes. Lecha osher umamlecha ve'ha'oz melifanecha ve'at moshel b'chol moshel v'nafshotam b'yadecha. Right? To you is the wealth and the sovereignty. And might is before you. And you are the ruler of all rulers. And their souls and their lives are only in your hands. V'ani ere v'agid la. Avashim alachotecha, veha iver asher lo ye, cheze hadrat kivodecha, veha ilem asher yidom, velo yagid pealecha, lecha hahod, veha kavod, badmatcha vishamecha. It's brilliant, a brilliant piyut. I don't know if you want to call it a piyut or poetry, but it really is a very, very beautiful poem. Lastly, here's one of his Selichot, Asher Natabesh Chakim. I believe this one here, which is written in his own Mishkal, this one is written more, this one was almost mimicked by the Ashkenazim. When the Ashkenazim received Shmuel HaNagid's Asher Natabesh Chakim, they mimicked this Selicha, and it actually was in the Minhag Romania, it was in the Minhag Halab in Greece, and in Ashkenaz, they said Shmuel HaNagid's Selicha. This is how far-reaching his poetic range was. One of the more interesting things I'll mention about his poetry is that he seems to have understood, he seems to have believed that when it comes to, he seems to have believed that when it comes to, when he wrote a piyut for synagogal use, he never used Arabic meter. So despite him being like half a generation after Donash, and perhaps being more comfortable with superimposing Arabic meter, when it comes to something he wrote specifically to be that is clear he wrote it for use in the Beit HaKnesset, he never uses Arabic meter. This is not true of later authors like Yehuda Levi and Shlomo ibn Gabirol, who are already much more comfortable with Arabic meter being a part of Hebrew verse. But Shmuel HaNagid was not yet comfortable using Arabic meter in Hebrew verse for something he considered exceedingly sacred. And we find this also on rare occasions with Yehuda Levi, where things that he wrote which he felt were personally very sacred to him, He did not use Arabic meter. He used the native, pure, syllabic meter of pure Jewish rhyme. Okay, we're almost done here, I promise. We're not going to be looking more at his poetic oeuvre together tonight because, honestly, it would exhaust everybody. It's beautiful, but it's very broad. I just skimmed through three of them in Sherman's collection, but everybody is welcome to go through, to download Dovi Ardain's books from his website tonight. Go through Diwans. They have a beautiful commentary for anybody who doesn't understand any of the rabbinic allusions, right? Besides his skill at poetry, he also cites Midrashim. Even in his secular poetry, he will sometimes you know, like use an allusion to Midrash, it's sometimes hard to decipher. So it's a good thing that that Pirush is there. His secular poetry, I just want to recap if anyone's going to go through his Diwan tonight, because you're interested. His Diwan contains a lot of secular poetry, some of it which you would not understand unless you understood Arabic poetry. There are Arabic conventions, artistic conventions, which are copied in the Hebrew, which are basically sinful. And they are poems about wine, about love, about lust, about eroticism. He has clearly homosexual poems inside his collection. And so just to recap what we discussed last week, although you might be mortified to find a rabbi of great stature writing homosexual or sexual poetry of that nature, you have to understand the artistic convention of the time. The best way I could describe this is if you have a sculptor or a painter who is being taught how to paint, and if they go to school to do that, they practice on nude paintings or nude sculptors. Doing that in school does not make you a pervert. It teaches you scale, texture, tones, color, skin tone, all sorts of skills that painters need when drawing human subjects. In the same way, a lot of the Jewish great rabbis and poets also wrote a lot of poetry in the Arabic convention. It's not clear if they were trying to demonstrate that Hebrew was also just as powerful, or if they were trying to practice in some way. But his son publishes them, and he clearly nobody in their time ever castigated him for writing, this secular type of poetry. Maybe because he was powerful, but even after his death, when his son published it, nobody ever raised the alarm that he was himself gay, or that he himself was bisexual, or that he himself was a drunk, or any of these accusations. So although he writes these poems, it is a stretch of the imagination that the poems are grounded in reality. Like Moshe Ben Ezra used to say, that one needs to never have loved to write a love poem. Meaning that a truly skilled poet can copy genres and conventions and copy them quite well. So that's just a brief explanation for anyone who's going to go through the Diwan of Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid in Hebrew. That's just an explanation for that. If anyone is interested in English, this book here, Selected Poems of Shmuel HaNagid by Peter Cole, is an English translation that tries to bring Shmuel HaNagid's poetry to the English-speaking audiences who are not familiar with Hebrew. A whole lot is lost in an English translation. A whole lot of appreciation is lost. He doesn't even, in Peter Cole's book, he doesn't even bring the Hebrew on the bottom to compare, so I find that considerably frustrating. But for anybody who wants to see the ideas and the tapestry and the sentiment and the mindset, you can get a gist of it from the English. The last person we're going to discuss tonight, and this is for all the feminists in the crowd, is a Jewish poet by the name of Kasmuna. Why am I discussing her tonight? Kasmuna is cited not by Jewish poets, not by Jewish historians, but by Arabic poets and Arabic historians. Kasmuna's name was, I believe, Kasmuna what's her name, her Arabic name? She is called, her father's name was Ismail al-Yahudi, right? Ismail ibn al-Yahudi, that's who her father was. He was called Ismail the Jew. Now, Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid was known as Ismail ibn Nagrela. So some have projected that perhaps Kasmuna, this Jewish woman who is known to have written Arabic poetry, was the daughter of Rav Shmuel HaNagid. Now, there's no evidence to back this up. It just comes from this knee-jerk reaction. How are you going to have a Jewish woman who is so educated and so literate that she's writing poetry of her own accord? And so Kasmuna has been identified along with Rav Shmuel HaNagid as perhaps his daughter. The only surviving poem, we have three poems from her. If you want to find on the Wikipedia page, it's Kasmuna, Kasmuna. She was a Jewish female poet, one of only two or three that we ever know of, who lived roughly in the 12th or 11th centuries. So therefore, it's not likely that she was, or Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid lived he was born in 993 and died in 1056. So, by the way, he died from exhaustion after a few wars. And it's unlikely that she was his daughter, but that is the legend. And the poems that she has are only in Arabic, not in Hebrew. It is only through the historians that we know she was Jewish. And her poems are longing poems and love poems and basically romantic poems. So that is That is the for the feminists in the room, that is the second of maybe only three. Esther of Yemen might be an exception if she was Jewish. Three known female Jewish poets in history, besides, I guess, Devorah, if that counts. But so concludes tonight's Shiur on Shmuel HaNagid. I hope that was everyone found that fascinating as much as I did. And I hope, Ezrat Hashem, next week to continue with perhaps Rabbi Moshe ben Ezra, one of the next great poets of Spain. So thank you, everyone, for your endurance, your attention, and we will continue next week. Just as an appendix to the shiur, I wanted to add one last thing, and that is that Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid was famous also for writing the Klalei HaTalmud. This is a short sefer, which is the rules of the Talmud, which until this day, if you open up a Vilna Shas, in the back of the Gemara of Brachot, they publish Rabbi Shmuel HaNagid's Klalei HaTalmud. So we, in his short, how long did he live? 50, almost 60-something year life, he accomplished more than just war and scholarship, but and poetry, but also a tremendous amount of Talmudic scholarship himself. So anyone who's interested can look at the back of Brachot and find one of his Sfarim from him there.